listen for the music. There we go.
It's the My Michelle Live podcast.
My Michelle Live, Sci Tech Talk, taking the God story to a geeky place. Here's Michelle.
Welcome. Oh, it's good to be back in the chair. We have been doing a few of our shows on the road, and that's been kind of interesting, introducing you to the beautiful state of Texas. But as I'm home, we are ready to get into science and technology. And man, every single week, we delve into the nuances of science. Every week, it becomes more fascinating, more interesting, and the God story, boom, explodes. You cannot get away from it, no matter how hard you try, but you're welcome to. And joining us in this journey today is Stephen C. Meyer. Now, he is an author. He's a former educator. He is also the Discovery Institute's director. He directs the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in my hometown of Seattle, Washington. He is also the author of a new book that is right along the lines of the kind of things that we like to talk about every week, Return of the God Hypotheses. We're going to take that on today and welcome again to our program. It's been a while and I'm so glad to connect with you, Steve.
It's great to be with you, Michelle, and welcome back to Seattle.
Thank you. It's a little cold, man. It's a little bit cold. That's okay. It's all right. I'm getting reused to it. I wanted to delve right into this concept of the deeper we go into science, the more we find about God. I have found that to be true. I know that in some of the aspects of science, people try to get away from that. They try to ignore it, but it is becoming more and more apparent that it's hard to escape the God story. Would you agree?
Well, there's a famous fairly ancient quotation from Francis Bacon, one of the founders of modern science, who said that a little philosophy, which is what they called science at the time, natural philosophy, he said, a little philosophy inclineth a man's mind toward atheism, but depth in philosophy returns a man's mind and heart back to his maker. And this is what we're finding. This is the story of 20th century and 21st century science. We had a period of time in the late 19th century with figures like Darwin and Thomas Huxley and Ernst Haeckel in Germany and Marx, and a little bit later Freud. The end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, the perspective of many scientists was decidedly materialistic, even atheistic. The idea that the universe was eternal and self-existent, didn't need an external creator. It had organized itself, and the main things we need to explain, the origin of the solar system, the features on planet Earth, the origin of life and the origin of new forms of life, had all been explained by unguided, undirected natural processes. And therefore, as an early 19th century physicist, Pierre Laplace is rumored to have said, I have no need of that hypothesis, referring to the God hypothesis of the earlier period of science with figures like Newton. But as we've entered the new century, and over the last 100 years, really, starting in the 1920s, discoveries in cosmology, in astrophysics, in physics, and in biology are all pointing to a designing intelligence, and indeed a transcendent designing intelligence, responsible for the origin of life in the universe. And I call that the return of the God hypothesis.
It's almost eerie in a way. For those who have had encounters with God, it's exciting, but you can't get away, I don't think, from that feeling, that take your breath away, goosebumpy, kind of like, are you kidding me, feeling of awe when we delve in. And what you were referring to is much like in your book, when you talk about the making of the scientific world picture, you know, how do we see science? Interesting, though, you also touched on, Stephen, that many of the ideas that have led us to this, science is God, and Actually, here's a, I don't know if you've been to Seattle or if you're in Seattle right now, but if you drive down I-5, folks, there's this crazy condo apartment building with glass. And you cannot miss it because they'll have like aliens up and it'll be lit up as you're driving down I-5 about Midtown with the lake on your left, all right, or on your right, depending if you're going north or south. Now, I say that because it struck me as I'm coming into town. There it is, that crazy. They always have it decorated, but they had a sign that said, "Science is God." We've come to that place. But interestingly enough, Stephen, we're basing a lot of our ideas from science on science that was popular 100 years ago. Why?
That's exactly right. the message to my book is different. It's that science points to God. Science right. is not God. That sometimes scholars call scientism or it reflects a worldview known as scientific materialism. And I love the way you put it, the scientific world picture. That's exactly how many scholars describe the role of science in helping to shape what are called worldviews, comprehensive philosophies that all of us hold one way or another, either by default or explicitly. And the scientific world picture that came out of the period known as the scientific revolution, with figures like Newton and Robert Boyle and Johannes Kepler, was a picture that was decidedly theistic. In fact, it was largely predicated on theistic ideas. I mean, the rise of modern science was predicated on theistic ideas, the idea that nature is orderly and that nature has a built-in rationality that is a product of a divine mind, and that we can understand that rationality because we're made in the image of the same creator who built the rationality, the order, the design into nature. This was one of the founding premises of the scientific revolution. The concept was it has a name. It's called intelligibility. Nature is intelligible to us because it's made by a divine mind who also gifted us with rationality. That perspective was lost in the late 19th century. A new scientific world picture came into dominance. It was materialistic. It was largely atheistic. And that was the period of time I was discussing about with Darwin, Marx, Freud, and those sort of figures. But since the 1920s, there have been three great discoveries that modern science has made that I think are pointing again in a theistic direction. The first is that the universe had a definite beginning. It has not always been here. It is not eternal and self-existent, thus and therefore not in need of an external creator. Secondly, the universe has been finely tuned for the possibility of life from the very beginning in its basic physical parameters, things like the strength of gravitational force or the masses of the elementary particles, or the fine tuning of the force that is driving the expansion of the universe. And the third big discovery is that the foundation of life, there is in every living cell, information, digital information stored in DNA and RNA. And this is perhaps the most extraordinary discovery of the 20th century, and maybe of all of science, that when we tried to figure out what was the secret of heredity, we discovered that there was actually an informational code that was present in every living cell. And this was the great discovery, first of Watson and Crick together, but then Francis Crick in 1957 advanced something he called the sequence hypothesis, suggesting that the chemical subunits of the DNA are actually functioning like alphabetic letters in a written text or digital characters like the zeros and ones in software. And we in the Northwest really should appreciate this because we are in this information technology economy. Yeah. Our local hero, Bill Gates, has said that DNA is like a software program, but much more complex than any we've ever devised. Leroy Hood, our famous biotech scientist in the area, has said DNA contains digital code. And so and that's fascinating because we know from experience that digital information in that form always arises from an intelligent source, from a mind, not a material process. Whether we're talking about information in a computer code or a paragraph in a book, or even the information that we're transmitting now over a radio signal, if you trace it back to its source, you come to a mind, not a material process. So the discovery of information at the foundation of life It's a powerful indicator of the activity of a designing intelligence in the origin and history of life.
Yeah, my mind is just going, poof. The exciting implications are absolutely mind-blowing. Every one of those three points really does point in profound ways. The third, as you were saying, that digital code, I'm reminded of a scripture that says there's nothing new under the sun. And every year we have, you know, something new with a cell phone. We have something new coming out in technology. But nothing in our technology, everything really is in essence biomimicry, isn't it? It's based on something that's already in existence and done better with more efficiency, with zero waste. It's amazing.
Let me tell you a story about that, Michelle. We had an elite architect level Microsoft programmer who took a leave of absence for a while to work with us to help. He wrote 10,000 lines of code to help us depict what's called the gene expression system, how the information in the DNA directs the construction of the proteins and protein machines that all cells need to stay alive. It's something the technology is very closely analogous to what they would use at Boeing, something called CAD-CAM, computer-assisted design and engineering, where digital information directs the construction of a mechanical system. And this programmer came into my office one day while he was working on this, and he threw this book down on my table with some, you know, little dramatic flair. And he said, I get an eerie feeling that someone has figured this out before us. And I looked down at the book, and the title was Design Patterns. And he went on to explain that a design pattern in computer engineering is an established method of storing or transmitting digital information. And he named some design patterns like automated error correction. He said, well, there's automated error correction in our computer. We've got a spell check, but we've got automated error correction in the cell as well. We've got hierarchically organized information. We've got files within folders, folders within superfolders in the computer, and information is hierarchically organized in the cell as well. And he went on and ticked these things off, and he said, I get an eerie feeling that someone figured this out before us, except what we're seeing is something like an 8.0, 9.0, 10.0 version of our own technology. There's an echo of our design strategies in the cell, but it's being executed with an efficiency far beyond anything we've achieved. So that's just the biology. And then in the physics, as I mentioned, we've got the fine tuning from the very beginning, suggesting design of the entire universe. And we also have the evidence, and we call this in astronomy and astrophysics, the Big Bang theory. But the Big Bang is not an explanation for the origin of the universe. The Big Bang is the first event, and it's an event that attests to the finitude, that matter, space, time, and energy had a beginning a finite time ago, and before which we can't posit a materialistic explanation for the origin of the universe, because it's matter and energy that came into existence at the origin of the universe, and before which there was no matter to do the causing. So these three developments suggest an intelligent agent responsible for life and the universe, but also an intelligent agent who has been active in the creation, because we see evidence of design after the beginning, but also an intelligent agent that in some way transcends or is separate from the universe, that it would have been capable of giving the finely tuned structure to the universe as a whole. No being within the cosmos. Some scientists have talked about space aliens as are possible designers, but no being within the cosmos could explain the origin of the universe.
Yes.
Or its fine tuning from the beginning.
And that's something that's very powerful about what we're calling the God story. Though, you know, we can look at it scientifically and say it's intelligent design. Sometimes, and maybe we can get to this later, you can see fingerprints or signs of the designer. You see in every work of art some kind of clue or something you can know about the artist. So perhaps we can get to that. But as we linger, you just said that in this beginning, in this Big Bang, in this origin of life, we cannot have something within this universe creating what happened in this universe. It had to be something outside of the dimensions that we experience in this. There are how many dimensions do they say that there probably are? Maybe 10 dimensions, whatever. However many dimensions, the being, or whatever it was that created this, had to be outside of those dimensions, outside of the universe, greater than the universe.
This is one of the reasons that I wrote the new book. I wrote two books previously, one called Signature in the Cell, and mm-hmm. another called Darwin's Doubt. And these were about the evidence for intelligent design we find in living systems, especially in information-bearing properties of living organisms. As I mentioned, if you have information, there's a famous information scientist who said that the creation of new information is habitually associated with conscious activity. The discovery of information as at the foundation of life, directing the show. I mean, in the 19th century, scientists thought that the two fundamental elements were matter and energy. And in 20th and 21st century science, we've learned there's a third fundamental entity, and that's information. And it's it's primary, it's foundational, because it controls everything that's taking place inside the cell. But it was at least logically possible to propose that the information necessary to produce the first life had arisen sometime previously within the cosmos, and that perhaps there was some designing agent somewhere else in the universe that was responsible. And some scientists proposed this. They proposed what's called panspermia, which was the idea that life was seeded here on Earth by some other intelligence within the universe that itself evolved by undirected natural processes. So that was a logical possibility, because after my first book, I just argued that an intelligent agent of some kind was responsible. Yeah. I didn't attempt to identify the attributes of the agent. But what I did in the new book is look at the evidence we have from physics and cosmology. And as I said, no being within the cosmos could be responsible for the exquisite and highly improbable fine-tuning of the universe from the very beginning, upon which its very existence depends. Similarly, no space alien could have explained the origin of the universe, because the alien also depends upon the prior existence of a universe being here. So when you look at those two pieces of evidence and remember a very basic principle of reasoning, which is the principle of causality, which says that whatever begins to exist must have a cause. If the universe began to exist, it must have a cause too. And yet, all causes are separate from themselves. So the cause of the universe must not be material or energy or space and time. It must be something separate from those domains that must transcend those domains. And that's beginning to sound an awful lot like God. In fact, when you look at the major worldviews, theism provides the best overall explanation for those three facts: that the universe had a beginning, that it was finely tuned from the beginning, and that we have had big bursts of new information into our biosphere since the beginning. That looks to me like a theistic designer, one who is transcendent but also active in the creation.
And how interesting that we used to think that it was the ignorant who would look at nature and say, oh, it must be a god. Look up at the sun and say, oh, we need to worship that because we don't understand it. And now, as we advance, it is really almost seeming, and forgive me if this sounds insulting, the ignorant that sits back and says, there is no God. We're going to get more of Stephen's thoughts on this and a lot of other stuff as we look through science on this SciTech Tuesday. You're the God Story. Stay with us.
Please keep your arms and hands inside the podcast at all times. Buckle up and enjoy the ride.
Never before has keeping it clean been easier for a product.
Or harder for a commercial. Tushy.
$40 bidet.
It's got your backside. At MyMichelleLive.com.
From the My Michelle Live podcasts, here's Michelle.
All right, on the SciTech Tuesday, we're continuing our conversation with Stephen C. Myers, talking about the God hypothesis. There was this, I guess you could have called it a hypothesis, many years ago, as man looked up into the heavens and worshiped the sun, moon, stars, because they just didn't understand it. How is that so different from what we're doing today, and what does that tell us about the God story? The God hypotheses, Stephen.
Well, and this is the difference between science as God or nature as God and the idea that science and nature point to God.
And so it's the same old argument. It's the same old ignorance.
It's the same argument from pagan times. In pagan times, people worshipped created things rather than the creator, as the Book of Romans puts it. And today there is a tendency not so much to worship nature, but to worship our own science, as if it were the science is just what we come to know about nature. But I think what we're really coming to know about nature is that it must have a source beyond itself. I attended a very important conference a number of years ago at Baylor University called the Nature of Nature. Several Nobel laureates were participating, and the presenting question of the conference was: Is nature self-organizing and self-existent, or does nature point beyond itself to something else, to a mind that has brought it into existence? So there's two great worldviews. One is called naturalism, the idea that nature is all there is. And the other is called theism, the idea that nature points to a God beyond itself. And in the new book, that I'm arguing for the latter point of view. And I'm doing so on the basis of scientific discoveries that really require an external explanation, an intelligent cause external to themselves to account for them. When we think about that, just the information present in DNA, the argument for intelligent design there is based on our uniform and repeated experience. We know from experience that it takes a mind to generate information. We know of no other cause of information, especially in a digital or alphabetic form. So we're using standard methods of scientific reasoning to come to the conclusion that matter and energy by themselves are not sufficient to explain the big events in the history of life in the universe, the origin of the universe, the origin of its finely tuned structure, and the origin of life itself.
I wanted to talk about some of that fine tuning and some of the what you talk about in the book, the Goldilocks principle or the Goldilocks universe.
Right. This is actually a phrase that a lot of physicists are now using, because when you look at these fundamental parameters, they fall within very narrow ranges, or what engineers call tolerances. One of the ways we know that the universe had a beginning is we have a lot of evidence that the universe is expanding, and that not only are the galaxies expanding outward, but space is expanding as the galaxies are moving outward. This is a consequence of Einstein's theory of general relativity, that space and time are connected. In any case, there's a force that is driving this expansion. It's called the cosmological constant. And if that force were a little tiny smidgen stronger or a little bit weaker in either direction, we'd either get what physicists call a heat death, where everything dissipates much too quickly for stable galaxies and rocky planets, for example, to form, or we would get what's called a big crunch, where everything would collapse back on itself due to gravitational attraction. But the force is finely tuned, and the accepted value is to about one part in 10 to the 90th power. Now, to put that in perspective, there are only 10 to the 80th. I'm talking exponential numbers here, one with 80 zeros after it, or one with 90 zeros after it. So there are only 10 to the 80th elementary particles in the entire universe. So to get the degree of fine tuning correct by chance would be like sending a blind man out into the universe and looking for one marked elementary particle. But of course, he's blindfolded, all right? And so, but not just in our universe, he'd have to be looking for one marked elementary particle in 10 billion universes our size. So the degree of fine tuning is beyond exquisite. It's hard to put into words. And that's just one of many independent parameters. So the probability of this is almost beyond computation. And yet this precision is what was required to create a life-friendly universe. So many physicists have said, for example, Fred Hoyle, that a common sense interpretation of the evidence suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics and chemistry to make life possible. So that's the concept of the fine tuning. The fine tuning suggests a fine tuner.
It does indeed, but we do know that there is this fight to reject, to cancel, to completely keep out of the conversation this God hypothesis, right?
Yeah, right. And there are also alternative hypotheses. And one attempt to explain the fine-tuning, just in the debate about biology, people have proposed space alien designers. In the fine-tuning debate, they propose what's called a multiverse. And that there are billions and billions of other universes out there. I sometimes say gabillions, but that's not an actual number, but lots. Okay. And so many, in fact, that the that a universe with our precise fine-tuning parameters would have had to arise by chance, inevitably, and we just happen to be in the lucky ones, in the lucky universe. That's the explanation. But there are two problems with that. First of all, if all we have are lots and lots of other universes out there, but they're causally disconnected from our own, then the existence of those other universes doesn't have any effect on what's happening in our universe, including whatever it was that set the improbable fine-tuning parameters in the first place. So just positing other universes doesn't solve the fine-tuning problem. And in recognition of that, the advocates of the multiverse have proposed that there are universe-generating mechanisms that function as a kind of common cause of all the universes, so that they can portray our universe as something like the lucky winner of a great cosmic lottery. And this is where the rub comes in. All these universe-generating mechanisms that have been proposed, whether they're based on something called string theory or what's called inflationary cosmology, even in theory, require exquisite fine-tuning, exquisite prior fine-tuning in order that these universe-generating mechanisms would actually spit out new universes. So the fine-tuning doesn't get explained. It just gets pushed back one generation to the
and
fine-tuning
so
of the universe-generating
mechanism.
It's
just one more way
mechanism.
To just kind of say, okay, let's just push off God just a little bit more. You get the vision of this big machine that it's like a conveyor belt, just kind of stamping out universes, just, you know, putting
them exactly.
Out.
That's the
boop,
picture.
But boop. And, you know, they're kind of substandard, but one turns out great. I have a guitar like that.
Yeah.
I have the most beautiful guitar. His name's Woody. This guitar was an inexpensive guitar. And as I went to the guitar shop, you know, they put out these guitars. They're all kind of the same. They send them out all over the world. And the inexpensive ones are like that, Steve. But this one guitar, as I tried the expensive ones, I tried ones in the few $1,000 range. This one $350 guitar outsounded them all. Somehow, some way, they had the right amount of wood, the right balance of glue. Everything came together perfectly. So it's much like those theories that you're talking about. However, someone still made the guitar.
Well, and someone still made the machine that made the guitar.
There you go.
You know, a colleague of ours who works on the fine-tuning argument, a philosopher named Robin Collins, likens it to the relationship between a recipe for bread and a bread-making machine. He asks you to imagine that some French chef presents you with a wonderful loaf of bread and he says, "This is my masterpiece. It's my greatest recipe, my greatest work of my intelligent ingenuity and design." And you say, "That's not, you didn't intelligently design that loaf of bread. I saw you put the dough in the bread making machine. There was no intelligent design involved whatsoever." And the chef says, "Well, wait a minute. I still designed the recipe for the dough. And besides which, the bread making machine was designed by somebody. So this is still the product of intelligence." And the multiverse hypothesis just pushes the fine tuning back to the universe generating mechanisms to try to push it out of view. But that means that even if the multiverse is true, there's still evidence of intelligent design, because we know of only one cause of what we call fine tuning. Fine tuning is just a shorthand way of talking about many improbable parameters that work together to achieve a functional end, or which exemplify a set of functional requirements. So we know of systems that are finely tuned, exquisite French recipes, internal combustion engines, Swiss watches, digital code, et cetera. All of these systems are finely tuned, and they all have one thing in common. They all came from a designing intelligence. Given that the multiverse doesn't explain the ultimate origin of fine tuning, the only remaining explanation for it is, in fact, intelligent design. And so the common sense interpretation that many physicists have elected of a fine tuner, I think, really stands. Intelligent design is the best explanation of the fine tuning, and it's present from the very beginning of the universe or soon after. It's not something that any being within the cosmos could have generated. So this points in a transcendent intelligence, as does the Big Bang itself.
It does. And maybe a being that is the same yesterday, today, and forever. It is truly intellectually dishonest to disclude the God hypotheses and to not delve deeper, because what are we really trying to do with science? Are we trying to find out truth, or are we trying to find ways to justify our own ignorance? That I guess that's where I'm at now.
Well, that's a very interesting point you raise, because there is a principle of scientific reasoning and method that has only existed really since the late 19th century, and it has a name. It's called methodological naturalism. And it just means that if you're going to be a scientist, you have to limit yourself to explanations by reference to purely materialistic or naturalistic causes for everything, including the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the nature of the human mind. But there's another possibility, and that is that creative intelligence played a role in the origin of the universe or the origin of life, and that our minds are not reducible to merely chemical reactions in the brain, that there's something that is beyond the physical, that is what we mean by being a human being, that our consciousness is not completely reducible to matter and energy. And if you're going to be an honest investigator, call a scientist or philosopher, we need to be open to the possibility that there are non-materialistic causes. And we know that our minds have a conscious experience that's not reducible. When I look it out and see the color red, that's not the same thing as the chemistry that's going on in my brain. There is a realm of mental experience that's different from the physical. And we need to be open to the possibility that minds can cause things. We do it all the time. You and I are causing things to happen as we're speaking. And it may be that a mind played a role in the origin of life in the universe. And so methodological naturalism actually shuts down inquiry and prevents scientists from following the evidence to where it most naturally leads. If you walk into the British Museum, you see the Rosetta Stone with all those wonderful inscriptions on it in the three languages. Yeah. Someone asks you, well, how did these come to be? If you're a methodological naturalist, you have to say something like, well, it must have been wind and erosion. But in fact, we know it was a scribe because we see the information there and we know that it took a mind to generate it.
Very, very good point. And I guess the question is, what are we afraid of? Now, I'm going to go back to the Bible, where the Bible, you see God often. You see written within front to back, test me, try me, prove me. Come, let us reason together. You see the praise of the Bereans who said, yeah, that sounds interesting, but we're going to go back and check that out. If God himself is not afraid of being challenged or questioned or let's find this out, who are we to say, nope, that's it, settled science?
Well, one of the most important chapters in the new book is called How to Evaluate a Metaphysical Hypothesis. A lot of times we think that there's no way to assess whether, say, belief in God or atheism or Eastern pantheism or what we call worldviews. There's no way to assess them, that they're just things we presuppose. There's a wonderful quote from one of the new atheists that I cite in the book. His name is Richard Dawkins. I disagree with him about his metaphysical hypothesis of materialism or atheism, but I agree with his claim that you can test such things. He says that the universe has exactly the properties that we should expect if at bottom there is no purpose, no design, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Now, what I like about the quote is that he's implying that his worldview of materialism, blind, pitiless indifference, or the, you know, no design, no purpose, that worldview, is testable by looking at the world around us to see if it has the properties that we should expect if materialism were true. And so I take him at his word and say, okay, yeah, let's do test that. And then what I argue in the book is that these three discoveries, that the universe had a beginning, the discovery of its fine-tuning, and the discovery of information at the foundation of life, what Dawkins himself acknowledges functions like machine code, that these discoveries are not at all expected on the basis of a strictly materialistic worldview. Materialism long affirmed that, for example, the universe was eternal, that it had always been here, and therefore did not need a creator. So I think you can test and evaluate metaphysical hypotheses, including the God hypothesis. The God hypothesis has certain expectations about what we should see in the world around us. For example, that the universe would have a beginning. Remember, the first words of the Bible are, in the beginning. That's definitely something you would expect if you were a theist. And you'd definitely expect to see evidence of actual design, which I think we do. So worldviews can be evaluated. And when in scripture, you know, God says in Isaiah, come, let us reason together. You know, he's not kidding. You know, it's possible to think about the evidence to see where it points. And I think it does indeed point in a Godward direction, if you will.
Yeah, there's two very profound points that have touched me with what you're saying. First of all, Richard's statement to begin with, well, we have the properties there that we can evaluate. The fact that there are properties there and that there's some kind of consistency that we can evaluate, look at mathematically, scientifically, kind of disproves this, oh, it just kind of happened thing because of that order. And that's exactly some of the points of your book. But the other thing that deeply touches me is that we can and we should be at a place where we say, look, your God thing, that's all cute and everything, but let's delve, as he said, into science. Let's just look at it. That's something that we should be doing. If this idea of a creator, and if some of what you allude to in the book that you can see evidence and signs of who this creator is not true, then let's just prove it, put it out there, and laugh away all of those crazy God people. What are you afraid of?
Well, absolutely. One of the things that I explain in the book is that there's a lot of, I'm just going to pick up on one word you used, which is proof. Okay. Because people, a lot of people get really hung up on this.
Sure. So we could say evidence.
Yeah. Science doesn't prove things with certainty.
Indeed.
And neither
Indeed.
Do hypotheses about the big questions prove things
well
with certainty. But we can't have strong evidence for beliefs. And just because you can't prove things the way mathematicians do with absolute certainty by deductive logic from self-evident axioms, doesn't mean that you can't have strong evidence. In courts of law, we say, you know, we convict mm-hmm. people on the basis of beyond reasonable doubt, right? So what I do in the book is show that there's kind of a middle way between faith and faith alone, faith without reason, on the one hand, and trying to establish absolute certain proof. And I use a method of reasoning that's commonly used in the sciences known as inference to the best explanation. We look at all the facts, we posit a number of possible explanations that would seem to be relevant to explaining the facts, and then we elect the one that provides the best explanation. And what I do in the book is look at not just competing scientific explanations for things like the origin of life, but also larger metaphysical explanations for the whole big picture, for as you put it before, for the scientific world picture. And I argue that theism provides a better overall explanation than deism or the Eastern philosophy of pantheism or strict materialism or even this kind of strange panspermia idea where you have a designer, but it's a space alien. And I look at some other metaphysical systems too and show that theism has unique explanatory power. Deism could explain the origin of the universe and the fine-tuning, but it doesn't explain evidence of design that arises long after the beginning, because deism, by definition, posits a creator that doesn't act after the beginning of the universe. Mm. The space alien might explain things that happen long after the beginning, but it can't explain things that happen at the beginning, including the origin of the universe itself. So as you look at the competing explanations with respect to the whole range of evidence that we have, oddly, the God hypothesis has unique explanatory power.
I have really loved your books, Darwin's Design, Signature in the Cell. You're very articulate, and you take scientific ideas and make them very palatable for non-scientific thinkers like everyday people, and I appreciate that. But this is by far my favorite book. It is so enlightening. It is so chock full of geeky, awesome science and a profound idea that there is not only a mind behind the universe, but that you can discover some profound things about that mind. And so I wanted to end our time together with all that you put in, and if no one, if someone hasn't written a book, the research, the information, there's probably plenty that you would have loved to include as well, but you have to whittle it down. And so you have all of that writing in your mind. And in all of this, what has it told you about this God or this mind behind the universe? What is your conclusion?
Well, I think you see many of the attributes of God reflected in nature. And this was one of the, this is a biblical idea. You see this in Romans 1 and Psalm 19. Romans 1 says, from the things that are made, the unseen qualities of the Creator are clearly manifest, his eternal power and divine nature, sometimes earlier translated wisdom. The Psalms say that in wisdom thou hast created all things. So you see this, a sense of definitely an intellect, but one that is far beyond our own. But another thing that I didn't talk a whole lot about in the book is the presence of beauty in nature. It's a problem in evolutionary biology. It's called the problem of gratuitous beauty, when organisms have, the coloration of tropical birds or Hawaiian fish. I'd love to snorkel when I go to Hawaii.
See
there's one called the Picasso triggerfish that looks like it was actually painted by one of the great masters. And then you've got 20 other species of triggerfish with different but equally beautiful patterns. And you think, do these differences have any relevance to which triggerfish is more likely to survive in the wild? Answer, probably not. This is just pure gratuitous beauty. It has nothing to do with Darwinian survival. And so how do you account for that? Well, perhaps a very good explanation is that the designer of the fish wanted them to be beautiful for our enjoyment. So I think you see something of God's attributes there. But I think one other thing that's worth commenting on is just that the importance of these questions to our personal lives. There was an article in the New York Times last week about how many people are experiencing a sense of purposelessness and meaninglessness, having been locked up with the COVID for a year. And I think that's true, but I think there's been a deeper source of angst, if you will, in the culture for quite a long time. And much of it comes from what the spokesmen for science have told us. One great physicist has said that the more we understand about the universe from science, the more it seems pointless. Lawrence Krauss, one of the great new atheist writers, said that that our scientific world picture suggests that human beings are insignificant on a scale that Copernicus could never have appreciated. Copernicus being the astronomer who put displaced the Earth from the center of the solar system, and many people thought, well, that makes us insignificant. But I think the idea of meaning is something that only makes sense in a personal context. And I think the new atheists are onto something. If there is no God, there is no ultimate meaning to human existence, because nothing can mean anything to a rock or an atom or to a planet or a molecule. Meaning is conferred by persons, and it's found in relationship between persons. And if there is no personal intelligence behind the universe, there can be no ultimate meaning to human existence, because when we die, we rot. And so the rediscovery through science that God is there, I think, is hugely significant, because it suggests the possibility of the kind of meaning that you find in relationship between persons, that there is a personal intelligence behind us, and therefore that our human search for meaning needn't end in vain if indeed there is a personal creator behind all of the universe.
So as we delve into the evidence, we can think of the implications, what that might mean to us. I mean, is there personal implications? So as you're listening or watching today, what a great interview. It gives us pause for thought. Who is this creator? Delving into that God hypothesis in your own life, and what does that mean? The personal aspect, the loving care, and does that point to the God of the Bible and a God who designed you and has purpose and love and desires a relationship with you? To me, that's the deeper story. That's the God story, and that's what we look for here on this program. Stephen Meyer is one of my favorite people to interview. Love everything he writes. The book is Return of the God Hypothesis: Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind of the Universe. It is a powerhouse house. I'm really looking forward to continuing to read what people have to say, you know, who like to try to slam things, because it gets harder and harder as science advances to slam what's going on in science, in the different disciplines of science, when you look at the God story. So it gets really exciting out there. And it's always exciting to speak with you, Stephen. I cannot thank you enough for making time for us today. So bless you.
Well, thank you for making time and for the great conversation. And it's great to be able to share some of these ideas with your audience.
Now go to mymichellelive.com. You can click the link and pick up the book yourself. I highly recommend it. Like us, share us, and get that God story.
More SciTech Talk at mymichellelive.com.
And that is, as they say, a wrap.
We did it.